Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
We start today with Congressman Richard Neal of Massachusetts 1st District. Neal chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, whose work was central in one of a pair of major Supreme Court decisions last week. It involved a subpoena of President Trump's tax returns by Ways and Means. The court found the president could not outright block the House's request, but sent the case back to the lower courts for more consideration on proper separation of powers. In the other case, notably, the court ruled that President Trump cannot claim complete immunity from prosecution while serving in office. Now, we spoke with Congressman Neal earlier this afternoon, and I began by asking him how he's reflecting on the court's rulings.
Well, I was very pleased with the Supreme Court decisions in both instances. I also was particularly delighted that Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh also agreed with the majority. We have made our case clear. I've approached this in a very methodical manner, understanding that there was great consequence. I thought our case was very carefully prepared, and we presented it from an individual, Doug Letter, who was the House counsel, who had argued four times in front of the Supreme Court. And my point there is that our job in this instance is never to entertain the American people. It's to inform them. So I was very careful. As recently as this week, I had Lawrence Tribe, a constitutional scholar, spend an hour plus on the phone with members of the Ways and Means Committee Democratic side. And Professor Tribe pointed out that in his opinion that we received a significant boost based on these two decisions. But most importantly, he also said that he thought we would ultimately prevail because our request was so well-crafted. In fact, he went on to say that had we moved faster or rushed our request, it's likely that, number one, we would not have been able to speed up the timeline, and number two, no guarantee of the outcome. So I think that the approach we took judiciously is going to pay off.
So I heard you say, had we moved faster or rushed our request. It seems you have in mind, I know you know, there is some criticism that House Ways and Means should have moved faster to seek the president's finances. You may be aware that the American Prospect recently published a piece headlined Trump's Tax Returns Remain Hidden, Blame Richard Neal. That is harsh criticism. You did come into House Ways and Means in January of 2019. Why not begin the process of seeking those financial documents in January rather than waiting until April?
Well, it's important to remember that, as you've noted, January of 2019, we assumed the majority. So that means in assuming the majority that the House attorney was positioned to seek these returns for the majority party in the Congress and for the majority on the Ways and Means Committee. We did not have that authority prior to January 19. In fact, we only prevailed in the November elections in 2018. So we used the time, again, to carefully craft a court case that we thought would stand up under the magnifying glass of critical analysis. And I might add that I think the same people that would have been critical of suggesting that you move too slowly, if you move too quickly and you erred, they would have said you move too quickly.
So what comes next for the case? And I want to ask you, is part of the House's objective to succeed in the lower court again and receive these documents before the November election?
Our case specifically is in front of Judge McFadden in the Federal District Court of Washington. He has indicated that he awaits a determination from the appeals court in the District of Columbia from the McGahn case. So it appears that there's been a pattern here of many of these courts taking a position that they're waiting for another court to act. And Judge McFadden did something that we all thought was pretty important early on when he said that I had standing to ask for these documents. So in that instance, we had already made substantial progress because the administration was arguing that this was about politics. Our position has been that it was not about politics. This was about legislative activity and the need to secure documents to proceed on the basis of evidence that had been procured through the process of subpoena, which we undertook to get the documents and were turned down by the administration.
And just to clarify, when you say McGahn, you mean White House lawyer Don McGahn?
Right. That case now, as you know, is, I think, by the way, boosted because of the Supreme Court decisions last week as to whether or not he has to offer testimony and evidence based upon charges that have been brought and requests that have been made. So we await that decision, and I believe that the Supreme Court gave some guidance last week in 7-2 decisions that were favorable to our position.
I'd like to shift gears, Congressman. We are in the middle of a pandemic, several months into a pandemic now. The CARES Act provides $600 a week for extra unemployment for Americans. It expires in about 2 weeks, if not extended. I know the HEROES Act passed in the House in May would grant that extension and give up to $6,000 in one-time stimulus payments to households, but the administration has basically declared that dead on arrival. The president does say he wants more stimulus money, and Mitch McConnell recently signaled at least some willingness. Do you think the House and Senate can put something together that will get passed and signed and will help carry this financial support through for workers in time?
Yes, I do. And in fact, I'm very proud of the fact that most of this legislation that has been successful so far has been written by the Ways and Means Committee. Unemployment insurance, as prescribed by the committee, has really been very successful. And it's clear that the administration and Majority Leader McConnell, they are about to go along with the position that we've offered in some form from the Ways and Means Committee that was included in the HEROES Act. Much of this legislation was authored in the first 8 days, starting about 14 weeks ago by Speaker Pelosi and I, in the Speaker's office, in which Speaker, myself, and Secretary Mnuchin on the phone, we drafted the parameters of the CARES Act. So in the CARES Act, there was substantial money for American hospitals in the first round, $175 billion. There was unemployment insurance, as you've accurately described it, which also had a one-time acknowledgement of an additional $600 that we negotiated successfully with the Senate, but that we also believe needs to be extended as well. There was a $1,200 benefit for a single filer making under $75,000 a year, and a $2,400 benefit for joint filers making under $150,000 a year. So it's our intention to proceed on the same course. This time around, that it should be easier because we already have all the tax ID numbers and we have the Social Security ID numbers. And we intend in this next round to extend the benefit, as you've described it, to college students who would claim dependency. And my point there is that we are hardly out of the woods, and complacency would be the worst thing that we could do at this particular time. We are not on the other side of the pandemic. The decision, I think, on unemployment insurance, the retention tax credit, and the stimulus checks have mitigated some of the harshness of what the pandemic has created. The pandemic was not about malfeasance. It was about a health matter and a priority. So I think that, as I've discussed this with Speaker Pelosi as recently as this weekend at Lent, and I'm going to be on the line with her after I hang up with you, we are determined to go forward with the HEROES Act, which the Ways and Means Committee wrote most of. We believe, once again, that making sure that unemployment insurance is there to cushion the challenges that people have in this difficult atmosphere.
Even the casual observer would be aware that it's been challenging for the House and the Senate to come up with legislation that they can agree on in advance. The unemployment provision in the CARES Act is essentially scheduled to expire on July 31st. Do you have optimism that the Senate, the House, and the President can find agreement in time to extend key provisions?
That's a terrific question, and I would say yes, assertively. And the reason I would say that is because the economic indicators at this time are anything but suggesting that we should be satisfied. But in addition to this, a very important statistic that's been underreported, despite Senator McConnell's position at the outset, despite the Republican position in the House of Representatives, the CARES Act passed the House 388-5. One Democrat in the House voted against the CARES Act. Four Republicans voted against it. The United States Senate voted for it unanimously. My point is that every one of these conversations has begun by Senator McConnell saying no, only to then say maybe, and then to say we have to do this. And the administration, including Secretary Mnuchin, they're really out front on this issue, suggesting this has to be done again. And those checks, this time around, need to be in the mail before July 31st.
Let's turn closer to home, Congressman, and I have in mind specifically the Holyoke Soldiers Home and the tragedy there where at least 76 veterans have died from the coronavirus. An independent investigation last month found dismaying infection control practices during the pandemic and faulted leadership there. Bennett Walsh, the superintendent, was fired. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Carlos Urena, resigned. Do you feel there has been sufficient accountability enacted based on what happened at the Holyoke Soldiers Home?
Well, we have the first analysis, as you know. We are awaiting investigations from the U.S. Attorney's Office and from the Attorney General's Office, and the legislature is probing the issue as well. It's a hybrid. While the United States Veterans Administration has a role, it is really superseded by the state of Massachusetts because it is really not a hospital. It's a soldier's home. And I have an uncle there. I'm there all the time. I was there as recently as 2 weeks ago. I know those families. I've met with them time and again. The plan is to be helpful to them as we go forward. I've also encouraged the governor to take a very aggressive role in capital investment at the facility. It needs a massive upgrade. If you were to visit, as I have, the dementia unit at the Holyoke Soldiers Home, one of the things that would have captured your attention is that the veterans literally sat on top of each other. The proximity didn't have air between it, I think, in some instances. So those visits would remind you that the facility was built at a different age. It was very old. And the contagion swept through the building almost like a fire. And I was there again just 2 weeks ago, met with some of the personnel, then went in to visit. Actually, I can't say we went in, met outside to visit with my uncle, who did have COVID, Korean War vet, who actually beat it. He's back on the mend. But this is a terrible tragedy. And I think that we await the investigations that are taking place, and then we ought to be able to make a very carefully considered decision. But the facility itself needs a massive investment of upgrade.
I'm glad to hear that your uncle is doing better, by the way.
Well, thank you.
And what are you hearing from families in Holyoke and elsewhere who have had loved ones in the home?
It's awful. I mean, and they come to you at some of these events and they bring pictures of the loved one who died. In a couple of cases, they've explained just how excruciating it was to not be able to go into the room to say goodbye to a loved one. In other cases, they had to look through the windows. They watched an individual succumb to the disease. And the rage that you might think that they would feel has really been channeled more toward a constructive outcome, where they want to see the improvements to the facility that we've just described. They do want some closure from these investigative agencies. But at the same time, they also want to make sure that going forward, that the facility receives the attention that it deserves.
Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse was key early on in exposing what was going on at the Holyoke Soldiers Home. He is challenging you in a primary. Primary day is rapidly approaching September 1st. We are in a moment of young progressive challengers seeking to, and in some cases successfully, unseating longtime Democratic congressmen like Ayanna Pressley with Michael Capuano, or as appears to be the case with Jamal Bowman and House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel in New York. We've got national progressive groups like Justice Democrats and the Sunrise Movement pushing and support for your challenger. Do you think voters in your district are looking for a change?
Oh, look, I feel pretty confident. I mean, 2 years ago, I received 71% of the vote in a contested primary. I work it every day. I think it'd be hard-pressed to come up with anybody who's been more visible through the COVID crisis. But let me also say something else that I think is really important. The Holyoke Public Schools are in receivership. When is that going to be acknowledged? He missed half of the meetings of the Holyoke School Committee as the chairman while these schools were put into receivership. He indicated that he would have voted against the CARES Act. I'm just flummoxed by that. In the CARES Act, there are, in the first congressional district of Massachusetts, thousands of jobs that have been saved by the CARES Act. $1.2 billion came to the Paycheck Protection Program alone. So I understand how somebody might feel if they think that they want to make this argument for change. But part of the change argument ought to be based upon the accountability that you diminished during your time as mayor. I'm contesting him in the city of Holyoke, but in addition, a reminder that he needs to tell us why he couldn't make it to school committee meetings while the Holyoke schools were put in receivership. there's one thing that is not in doubt after all my years of service. I care about those children in the Holyoke Public School System.
Congressman, author and journalist David Daley wrote an op-ed about your spending in the Boston Globe last year, making harsh criticism, pointing out that you raised over $500,000 in your first 3 months as Ways and Means Committee Chair, and accusing you of engaging in pay-to-play. That's a quote, politics. And your challenger is making those arguments, too. I do want to ask, how are you addressing these claims, which have been made publicly, with your voters?
Well, I think it's very simple. I think that you, as the law requires, you receive contributions, you report them, and under critical analysis, they're reviewed, and the voters make up their minds. I imagine that Mayor Morris did not point out that there are a series of car dealerships in Holyoke that received massive tax benefits and then wrote checks to him. And I assume he didn't point out that the State Department of Finance has time and again questioned his reporting where he's received and how he's received campaign contributions. And not to miss the point that the schools in the city of Holyoke are in receivership.
I just do just want to note, I don't have the background on the car dealership claims that you were making. We will go back and take a look at those here on Radio Boston later. Let's step back to the broader picture again for one last question.
Sure.
We are in an election year, not just for you, but at the federal level and all around the country. What is at stake for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in November 2020, and what's at stake for the country?
Well, I must tell you that having had long experience that I never thought this could happen in America with the Trump presidency, but I also think that we've allowed entertainment to seep into mainstream political thinking when our job, as I noted at the outset, is not to entertain but to inform. There are those of us who along the way have embraced science and fact-based analysis. And transparency. And I think in the case of President Trump, it's literally 24 hours of entertainment. And I also would say that when you suggest to the American people that put a shot of Clorox might provide your immune system with protection against COVID, that's the result. So we all go through this every day, this exercise of listening to what the president has to say as he weaves his way in and out of falsehoods. But the truth is that the best way to combat this is to support our institutions, get out there and vote in November, and let's have a change of administrations in Washington. I think Joe Biden, based on a long career, is a very decent human being, will make a fine president. It's certainly better than the current occupant of the White House.
That was Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal. And listeners, we reached out to Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse's campaign to ask about the congressman's claims about local car dealerships. In a written statement, Morse said, quote, "These are local community members, residents of the district, and local business owners that have invested in the city and have invested in my leadership and my vision for the city of Holyoke," end quote. We will continue to follow this congressional race and invite both candidates to join us here on Radio Boston. It is that time of year again.
Oh, help! Does anyone have a calculator?
Myron?
No.
Will you look at those morons? I paid my taxes over a year ago.
Dad, that was last year's taxes. You have to pay again this year.
No, because you see, I went ahead and year-wise, I was counting forward from the last previous... So!
I put the tax forms on top of your to-do pile a month ago.
I have a to-do pile?
That's right. Tax day is here in July. Check your to-do pile. After a three-month extension, due to the coronavirus pandemic, the extension brought relief to many taxpayers who have been impacted by business shutdowns, store closings, and lockdowns nationwide. But with mounting concerns about the state's economy, what has the extension meant for the Commonwealth, really? Here with us to talk about that is our friend of the show, Evan Horowitz, who is the executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University and former Boston Globe economics reporter. Welcome back, Evan.
Thanks so much, Tiziana. That clip is priceless.
It is, isn't it? And also with us is Greg Bialecki, who's a principal at the investment firm Redgate, and also former Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development during and in the years after the Great Recession. Welcome to Radio Boston, Greg.
Hi there.
All right, so, you know, I understand, both of you, that talking about taxes is not the most exciting thing, but in our current economy, it's actually an incredibly important thing. We have to take a look at how things have changed since the original April 15th deadline when the pandemic was just heating up. So I want to ask you, what have we learned and how have things changed since then? Do you think the extension was the right thing to do? Evan, why don't you go first?
Oh, I think for sure it was the right thing to do. I mean, the level of uncertainty in the economy at the time was immeasurable, really. And businesses didn't have a sense for what their revenues were going to look like. If they paid their taxes at that time, could they stay in business? There was really no option, no good economic option, but to let businesses have a little reprieve, figure out what their cash flows look like, whether they could stay in business, how to stay in business. And this three-month delay helped them figure that out.
And Greg, what did people figure out? What do we know about how things have changed?
Well, so I agree with Evan that the three-month delay was a good thing. But the question is, was it long enough? And really, have we learned what we hoped to learn? We thought maybe if we gave ourselves a three-month delay, we'd understand a little bit better. Maybe the disease had calmed down. Maybe the economy was starting to come back. Maybe we could be on the other side of this and figure out how to get out of it. But unfortunately, as it turns out, the 3 months were still, I think, very early in the process. And it's, for example, we're going to learn a lot about April used to be the big tax month for the state. Now this will be the big month for state tax receipts. And we really don't know how much money the state's going to collect. And that's another good indicator beyond the unemployment rate of how our economy is really doing here.
So to that point, Greg and Evan, maybe I'll turn to you on this. Greg was saying, you know, turns out we thought we might be further along and we're not. Some, you know, would argue, we might argue at least, that we were in a kind of a more optimistic place in the spring, thinking 3 months might be enough. We might get a hold on the virus. Clearly, we do not have a hold on the virus nationally. Some businesses haven't been able to survive the pandemic. That may be worse given where the economy is. So how does that impact tax collections?
Well, I think at this point, you need stimulus way beyond the deferral of tax day. So this was meant to be a temporary reprieve. That's what you got. But it's certainly true. Small businesses need a lot more support. There's talk of extending loan programs. The Fed has a new Main Street lending program. But with a vaccine months and months away, it does seem like small businesses in particular need a lot more support to survive this economic crisis that we're in. But the state also, I mean, Greg mentioned the state. This was a huge issue for the state to give up money in 1 year. Remember, the state's years are different from calendar years, right? The state budget years, they run from July 1st to June 30th. So by deferring tax day from April into July, you actually moved all that revenue into the next year. And it really threw off the state budget. So figuring out now exactly how much money we deferred is going to help with planning for the coming year, which is really essential for healthcare, for education, for getting schools open, for figuring out how much money we have to support people in the Commonwealth.
There is a bunch of stuff about the state that I want to ask, but before we go there, I want to stay with individual taxpayers for just a minute longer. I think the average person doesn't really think about, unless they own a small business, I think the average person thinks about tax day as when they pay their personal income taxes. But there really are some questions, especially for small businesses who have delayed 3 months, and maybe that's been a good thing, but are still in the time of great uncertainty. Greg, can you kind of comb out for us what July 15th tax day is likely to mean for individual taxpayers versus businesses and small business taxpayers?
Yes. Well, for individuals, as you say, for the vast majority of working people, they are withholding taxes through their payroll. And so they might not owe a lot on the typical tax collection day. They might be even hoping for a refund on their tax collection day. So those people are not substantially affected. And then the people who have who would owe more, the people for whatever reason had a very good 2019 and had more income than they expected. So for their personal reasons, they're probably going to be okay too. On the business side, what we're seeing is just that the cash flow of businesses is so terribly important. You may have a business that is still a good business, and there's reasons to think it can make it through if it can just manage its cash in the short term. And that's tax payments, that's rent, that's all those other issues. And I think you're seeing in a variety of fronts how do we just give small businesses the liquidity to make it through? It may not even be big dollars amount, but when you're a small business and you have no incoming revenue, just getting from month to month, not having to pay certain obligations for a month or two or three more is a big deal.
So let's stay with that, Evan, with Greg's point right there about cash and liquidity. When I ran an organization, to say that I became hyper aware of the difference between my cash and my revenues was probably an understatement. You know, with cash being how much money you have on hand and revenues being how much you earn and are going to earn. It seems like we're at kind of the red siren level for a lot of small businesses on cash liquidity, to use Greg's term. Are we also concerned about red siren levels on revenues, medium and long term? Do we have a double-edged problem here?
I think we do have a big problem. And the cash problem becomes a sustainability problem. That is, it could be that tax day becomes a kind of forcing mechanism for businesses to decide whether they can survive or not, whether it's time to declare bankruptcy because it's just too big a hit on the cash front. You know, today's the day I owe this money. I thought I was going to owe it in April, but I didn't then, and I used that money that I had set aside for taxes just to keep operating for a couple months in hopes that things would come together. But here we are, 3 months later, they haven't come together. I've used up all that money. I have no choice now but to go out of business, declare bankruptcy. I do think this is a legitimate concern and a real problem for businesses because this will be the first of many such things. You know, we have tax day, which will be a kind of first forcing mechanism. There's a chance that expanded unemployment insurance goes away, some of the other supports that the federal government's been providing go away, and little by little it's going to force businesses to close down.
All right, so now let's turn to the state. And Greg, Evan talked about the fact that the fiscal year ends on June 30th, but tax day wasn't until July 15th. You were the Secretary of Housing and Economic Development. When you heard that sort of the revenue day was going to be pushed out past the end of the year, what did the part of you who used to be a state administrator think?
Well, it feels a lot like 2008 and 2009. You know, typically in this state and most states, the budgeting is a once a year activity. The governor and the legislature sit down with economists and business leaders. They try to make the best forecast of what the economy is going to be like, what the tax revenue is going to be like. And they're usually able to make a pretty good estimate. And they do that once for the year and how much they're going to collect and how much they're going to spend. And that survives with very modest adjustments for a whole 12-month period. Back in 2008 and 2009, we had to abandon that process. And we had to admit that we were essentially going to be recalculating the budget every 3 months, how much we thought was going to come in, and how much we had to spend. And so that was a huge difference in the way the state government worked, but it was a reality because you knew that you simply had no way to predict what the economy was going to be like and what tax revenue is going to be like in 6 months. And that's exactly where we are now. If anybody told you they thought what the 12 months from now would be like, you couldn't have any confidence in that. You certainly couldn't spend all that money hoping that the taxes would come in because you just don't know.
And let me ask both of you, in times of financial crisis or where there are shortages, I'm thinking about what goes first. So I'm struck by a letter from the Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation back in April to the Executive Office of Administration and Finance suggesting postponing the implementation schedule. This was for the Student Opportunity Act passed last year, which was the school funding bill that was hard work and widely hailed as being beneficial for marginalized and low-income students. So here you have low-income and marginalized students and students of color at a time when we not only have a pandemic, but also a national awakening on racism and imbalance, but it sounds like they may be vulnerable. Who gets affected when the money runs short?
Well, I mean, I would say two things. First is when you're thinking about the budget, you have to think in terms of trade-offs because, you know, the state can only spend as much money as it takes in. It's not like the federal government. There's no opportunity to really run a deficit. So you have a certain amount of money. It can only go to a certain number of places, so there are trade-offs, and you have to choose. This is going to be, the math is brutal at times in that sense. Schools or Medicaid. Remember, most state money goes in one of those two directions, either to education or to healthcare. And if you have to make big cuts, odds are it's going to be in one of those places. The other side is, of course, you could raise new revenue. You know, and in past recessions, the state has done that. The other point I wanted to make is that July will bring some clarity, I think, to the kinds of trade-offs that are necessary. One of the issues with deferring tax day from April to July is that it confounded a couple of things. The state couldn't tell whether it was taking in less revenue because of the deferral of tax day or because the economy had collapsed. And it will finally be able to sort that out now that we get the tax collections. It'll be a lot clearer how much of the lost revenue is due to the fact that the economy collapsed. And once that's clear, you'll know exactly what kinds of trade-offs you're really facing, and you can start making these tough decisions about, well, are we really going to delay implementation of this change to the education funding formula, or should we raise new taxes, or is there some other way we can find savings?
So, Greg, we're on a hard clock. We've got about a minute left. Let me ask you, if you were advising state officials now based on your experience, what should planning look like and where are key priorities?
Well, first of all, you've got to become short-term thinkers. You have to realize that whether it's 2 or 3 months at a time or whatever, that we just we're getting new information all the time. As Evan says, that today's tax revenues will be another data point. Next month's unemployment rate will be. We just have to take it one small step at a time. And be mindful that it's going to take us a long time to get out of this. Even if COVID clears up, the unemployment rate's going to stay high for the next year or two, probably. And so we have a long way to go. And I do want to add to you, Sandy, you made a great point about priorities. What happens a lot is the things that have been in the budget for a long time tend to stay, and the newer things tend to be seen as more disposable. And that's not the same as really picking which are the most important social priorities. And so it is important to think about that as well. Maybe some of the newer items that we brought online are in fact just as important to fund as some of the items that have been in the budget for a while.
Okay, and that's Greg Bialecki, a principal at the investment firm Redgate and former Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, and Evan Horowitz, Executive Director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
The Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum reopens for visitors today after closing in March because of the pandemic. Back on View is an exhibition titled Boston's Apollo. It explores the story behind a John Singer Sargent mural at another institution, the Museum of Fine Arts. Singer Sargent's Apollo and the Muses graces the MFA's rotunda. Completed in 1921, it portrays white gods and goddesses dancing and playing music. Although all of the deities are white, it turns out the primary model for the figures was a black man. Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum curator Nat Silver made the discovery.
I first came across a folder of drawings in the Gardner storage facility, which I had never seen before. They were 10 works on paper signed by John Singer Sargent. And I thought, how have I not seen these before? As I looked at these drawings, I realized that they were studies for the murals that Sargent had done next door at the Museum of Fine Arts. But the man in the drawings was black, and all the figures on the ceiling were white. And I thought, what's going on here? I want to know more about this man and his role in the creation of one of Boston's great public works of art.
That led to a 3-year-long effort to tell the story of the man in the drawings, Thomas McKellar.
Thomas McKellar was a Roxbury resident. He was a veteran. He left Wilmington, North Carolina in his teens in the wake of devastating racial violence. There were very few opportunities for young black men in Wilmington anymore. So he came to Boston, at the very least, looking for new opportunities. By the 19-teens, he settled here in Boston, working as a bellhop at the Hotel Vendome. And it's 3 years later, in 1916, that John Singer Sargent meets him in the elevator of that hotel and invites him to come to his studio and model for the commission that he's just received from the Museum of Fine Arts.
The relationship between the men lasted 8 years, and Singer Sargent would specifically request to work with McKellar on each visit to Boston. McKellar also served as the model for a Singer Sargent mural at Harvard's Widener Library and a portrait of Harvard President Abbott Lawrence Lowell. In each work, his black body is transformed into white figures. Here's Silver again.
So he becomes really the unsung hero of Boston's public artworks, and it's only today that he's finally getting the credit for what he did.
And his compensation was nowhere near what Singer Sargent received. For instance, Singer Sargent was paid $40,000 for the mural at the MFA. McKellar only received $30. This exhibit examines broad power differentials between the two men and seeks to uplift McKellar's life. When it went on view, we visited the museum to learn about McKellar's important and largely unknown story. Now, as the exhibit reopens during an urgent national conversation on race, it feels even more salient. When reached yesterday, Silver told us the questions in Boston's Apollo mirror those being asked by the protests.
I think these conversations, these questions were being asked in many communities across the United States, in Black communities perhaps, but they needed to happen beyond that. They needed to happen nationally. And if this exhibition can contribute to that and can help foster those conversations, and I think we're doing our job.
The exhibition was put together by Silver and museum staff, but also included, quote, community collaborators, end quote. Those were mostly artists, writers, and curators of color who were not on staff at the museum, but who directly contributed to the creation and presentation of the exhibition. On our visit, we spoke with Silver and one of the community collaborators, writer and curator Theo Tyson. We began in front of a tremendous Singer Sargent portrait of Thomas McKellar. And I asked Tyson about how she felt when she first learned about McKellar's existence.
Surprised, certainly surprised to know that one of his best and longest muses was a Black man. I was completely blown away.
As you processed that, what was your reaction?
I think I might still be processing it.
Fair enough.
The idea of him being such an integral part of works that are still so critical, still critically acclaimed today, and to know that he was completely erased. No one had heard of him. People didn't know his story. Even his family wasn't aware of how important he was to the arts.
Nat, why do you think these sketches were preserved in the first place?
Well, we know that Sargent gave these sketches to Isabella Stewart Gardner. It was probably around 1921, so right as he was finishing the rotunda at the Museum of Fine Arts. And he knew that Gardner had a museum. So by giving these sketches to her, he was preserving these works for the public. He knew that the public would see them one day, even if it wasn't in Sargent and Gardner's own time.
I'm really zeroing in on your term one day, because it does make one wonder, was he essentially banking on them not being public until one day?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer to it, is the honest answer. If Sargent gave these to Gardner in 1921, Gardner had already had a stroke, and she wasn't reinstalling her museum and adding works to the public display in the way that she might have been 10 or 15 years earlier. So we have to take that into consideration. Then we have to think about the fact that these were large format drawings of a nude Black man. And at the time, this might have seemed shocking. So perhaps there was a sense in Sargent's mind that these were not something that the public could handle at that time, or perhaps something that he was not ready to share with the public.
Theo, what is your thought about this question I have of whether one day was an on-purpose move by John Singer Sargent versus releasing those drawings or putting them on display somewhere at that time?
I do feel like in his mind one day he wanted these to be seen and wanted them to be known. The fact that he actually went and signed each of them, the scale of the drawings, the immaculateness of the drawings, the fact that he kept them in his studio. There are all of these personal relationships. It just, to me, highlights the intimacy and what the connection that he must have had with Thomas McKellar, not only keeping them, but holding them very close to him. It's still shocking now to learn of these and to challenge what the relationship may have been and to look into, was this more than muse and artist?
Theo, in describing the drawings, you used the word intimacy.
Yes.
We're standing in front of the portrait of Thomas McKellar, which strikes me as a very intimate portrait. I wonder if you can describe it for our listeners.
Wow. Describing this is, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. It's it's striking, and you know how much time it took. The pose that he's in with his neck elongated, head back, gazing towards the sky, arms and shoulders very, very strong, legs in very awkward positions behind him. You can only assume how many hours he must have sat with Sargent to get this drawing. We don't know how many sessions it may have taken. You can see the whisper of angel wings behind him. And one of the things that I've noticed about all of the drawings, and particularly the portrait as well, is there's never a direct gaze from Thomas McKellar to John Singer Sargent. And to me, it imitates the idea that he was never able to be completely direct about the intimacy that the two of them shared. And having McKellar always gazing off kept him from connecting with him in a way that wouldn't have allowed him to deny their relationship.
What do we know about their relationship?
This was, at the very least, an intense relationship. It was a long-term relationship over the course of 8 years. Certainly a professional relationship, but at the same time, there's no reason to doubt that it couldn't have grown into a personal or romantic relationship. We now pretty much accept that Sargent was gay. We don't know much about Thomas McKellar's sexuality, and I think these drawings, and certainly this painting, raise that question. It speaks a lot to Sargent's opinion of Thomas McKellar that he kept this portrait of Thomas McKellar in his own studio, in the artist's studio, until he died in 1925. This was only for him and for the small circle of people, friends or family, who he might have chosen to share it with.
There are so many power differentials at play in this relationship. I was struck by some information I saw on the wall coming into the exhibit that McKellar was born 2 years after John Singer Sargent painted Isabella Stewart Gardner. If, in fact, both men were gay, there's a power differential in that knowledge and who would be believed and who could speak. So there's so much going on that is profoundly uncomfortable and that I want to unpack. I think I would start by asking, how unusual is it to have an artist use a black model and then paint them white into all of their work?
It's still a challenging conversation to unpack today. One of the things that we can say is it was artistic practice. If you have a muse or a model, they are not in control of what the final image is going to be. He could have very, very easily gotten white models to model for him for Atlas, for Eros, or whatever, but he specifically requested McKellar. It says a lot about what McKellar had to offer Sargent that he wasn't able to find anywhere else.
It may sound today very easy for Sargent or for an artist to invite a model into his or her studio, but we know at the time that for a white artist, it was actually difficult to find a black model who was willing to come into the studio and pose. We know that from St. Gaudens, who created the Shaw Memorial on Boston Common, and we have his account, so this is in the 1890s, of trying to get black models to pose for the soldiers, the Civil War soldiers who were depicted in the Shaw Memorial. And so he went out, literally went onto the street and asked black men he saw walking by to come back to the studio with him. He records some of their reactions, and they were extreme. The men didn't know him. They thought he might be trying to kidnap them. They thought he might be trying to perform some sort of medical procedure on them. Many of them just ignored him. Some of them ran away. So just that very assumption that we would have today of, inviting somebody into the studio is just a very easy thing to do. It's not. And I think that really emphasizes, as Theo is saying, that Sargent forged a relationship with Thomas McKellar that allowed that to be possible.
I'd love to move us back towards the front of the exhibit, where there's a timeline that tells us more about the life and history of Thomas McKellar. And there's also in that room reflections from local artists about the exhibit, the relationship, what we now know. So let's go there and let's talk some more. So we're standing here in front of a timeline called Thomas McKellar's Boston, and it's got some information about his life, too. So, Theo, there is something so striking about the fact that for the first time in 117 years at the Gardner Museum, there is an exhibit that is dedicated to images of a black man. and it is a black man who, to use a word I've heard you use, has been erased from the art. And in fact, his likeness is used to reaffirm an image of godliness that is white. I don't even know where to go with the irony packed in all of that.
Where do we begin? It's something that's still happening today. It's challenging as a curator, as a writer, to look at something historically, because we only have our contemporary lens. We only know what we know now. We don't know exactly how people interacted then. There are several comments that Sargent made that were derogatory about McKellar, using just very derogatory terms that are often used for black people, but there was still this compulsion for him to, he had to have them. He had to have McKellar. And it's this idea of the commodification of black bodies, parceling them out for whatever is necessary and then throwing away the rest, to have Thomas McKellar on full display and uplifting him is golden. And I think this is the answer to the question of, do we owe Thomas McKellar something? And we do. We owe him his dignity, his integrity, and his identity. And this exhibition is a huge step in the right direction in giving that to him.
Theo, we just walked essentially in reverse back through the exhibit. When somebody begins here and makes their way through it, at the end, what lesson do you want them to have learned, or what do you want to be on their minds?
I want them to think about the consistent contributions that black people and African Americans have made to this country across the board. When they look up, they have the idea that black people can be elevated, we should be elevated, and we always have been. There are so many people, I'm sure, that when they look up at the murals in the MFA, it would never cross their minds that these white gods and goddesses would not have been possible were it not for a black man.
For either of you, how did working on, or did working on this exhibit make you rethink John Singer Sargent?
It definitely made me look at Sargent very differently. My first introduction to him was Madam X, the beautiful portrait with the gorgeous black dress that was also quite controversial. To have someone that we have put on a pedestal as this amazing artist, and we can't take that away from him, but he was a complicated man. And I think this made me look at him differently, but then also go back and look at some of his other works very differently. Has he been trying to tell us a story that we still haven't discovered? Was this like a little crumb on the way to discovering the true history of John Singer Sargent? And maybe he knew the only way to tell that was through Thomas McKellar. So it's in researching for Boston's Apollo and digging more into Sargent's past, and I'm still looking at him differently and still making discoveries, and I hope that doesn't stop.
That is our conversation with writer and curator Theo Tyson and Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum curator Nat Silver. Boston's Apollo will be on display at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum through October 12th. For more information and to see the portrait of Thomas McKellar, visit radioboston.org.